as a talk, an informal talk, as would be a lecture. I would like to mention right at the beginning, please feel free if there's something I'm saying that is unclear, or if you have a question, feel free to break in at any time. I will try to speak no longer than 40 minutes to 45 minutes, so there will be time for questions afterwards. And I'll remind you that we do have coffee, well, hot water and coffee and tea available after the lecture, and I'll be available afterwards to talk about any questions you might have. I should also mention, I won't be doing much with this, but I have up here some specimens of ancient plants that have been recovered from excavations. Most of these are from the Bab el-Draa and Nemera excavation in the southern part of the Dead Sea. So they all date from the early Bronze Age, between 3000 and 2000 BC. And they're all labeled to tell you what they are, so if you want to come up afterwards, feel free to do so and to look over that material. When you begin to talk about archaeology, or just say the word archaeology in this part of the world, it seems to me that the thought that comes into most people's minds almost immediately are places like Jerash and Petra, where you have monumental architecture. That's the thing that we more or less immediately think about. Or if you've been in Jordan for the past couple of years and have taken some courses of Jim Sowers or listened to some of Jim's lectures, you might think of a mound covered with pottery. Certainly, those are the two things that Middle Eastern archaeologists have concentrated on up until now, that is pottery and architecture. And of course, they're both very important, especially as chronological tools. Again, if you've done anything with Jim, you know the importance of pottery for dating different occupation levels in an ancient site. Architecture is the same. From the architectural designs, you can tell something about when the building was constructed, by whom it was constructed, and so forth. Pottery and architecture also can give you some ideas of what kind of trade was going on, exchange of ideas, and so forth. But there is a limit to what you can find out from the study of architecture and pottery. These days, one of the questions that you'll find a lot of anthropologists and archaeologists asking is not so much what are the dates of the early Bronze Age. That is something that's still debated back and forth, trying to nail down more precisely when certain periods end or begin, when new people come in and out. But more and more, you'll find people asking, what was the ancient climate like? What were people eating? What changes took place in the ancient environment? And we just, up to this point, for this particular part of the world, we don't know that much about those questions, the answers to those questions. It's too bad because, in fact, we could, it's certainly possible that we would have known a lot more about what the ancient environment was like, what people were doing in daily life, what their diet was, and so forth, if people would have been paying more attention as they were digging to the plant remains that they were throwing out in the dumps. But in the early days of archaeology, especially in this part of the world, since architecture and pottery were two things that were most concentrated on, the plants were more or less ignored, and therefore a lot of valuable information was lost. But as there has been more concern in trying to reconstruct the ancient environment, ancient agricultural systems, and so forth, the study of plants, as well as bones, lithic tools, and so forth, has become more and more emphasized. This has led, in recent years, that's a little bit misleading, I guess. You could say that the study of ancient plant remains certainly goes back to the mid-19th century, but it's only been within about the last 20 years, 10 to 20 years, that the study of plant remains has really taken off in a big way. And This has led to the development of a study or a field of research known by various terms. One of the terms, which was probably new to some of you anyway, kind of a typical modern scientific term, and people like to make big words. Paleoethnobotany is the new field. There are a number of other terms. This goes by either paleoarchaeology or archaeobotany. It's not as complicated as it looks. If you know the Greek, paleo means ancient, ethno has to do with cultures, races of people, or cultural groups, and of course, botany we all know. So paleoethnobotany is the study of the cultural use of ancient plants, or the exploitation of ancient plants, or plants by ancient cultural groups. Although some work was done in the early part of the 20th century with paleoethnobotany and paleobotany, most of the early work was done in Europe. Few exceptions are some of the tombs in Egypt did yield some plant material, and that was studied. But there was no real concerted effort to recover and analyze botanical material from European sites. Most of the study was done in Western and Eastern Europe. And today, the stimulus for paleoethnobotany in the Near East seems to me to have come more from the New World than Europe, even. In North America and South America, the so-called New World archaeology. One of the things that you don't find is as much monumental architecture or pottery as you do in this part of the world. And at least it seems to me very likely that that's one of the reasons why New World archaeologists have concentrated more on the analysis of lithic tools, the analysis of human and animal skeletal remains, the analysis of plants, pollen and so forth, because they haven't had all this rich material that we have in the Near East. So perhaps there's more of that kind of thing, pottery and architecture in the New World, in the study of plant remains would never have become as important as it is right here. Since the paleoethnobotany in the Near East is still a fairly recent development, it's not that easy to get information about what plants have been recovered in this part of the world and what interpretations are being made. One journal, I thought I'd mention just a few names of journals if you're interested in learning any more about this subject. There is a journal called Economic Botany. I haven't seen it here. It's available in the States, and I would imagine somewhere here in Georgia you should be able to find it. There are often articles in that particular journal dealing with different types of plant remains that are being found in archaeological sites. There are a number of books that are coming out these days on the origins of agriculture or prehistoric agriculture. This is a fairly decent book, the Domestication and Exploitation of Plants and Animals, in which you can find some very good information. And this is kind of standard work, although it's only about 10 years old. It's somewhat outdated, Paleoethnobotany by Jane Renfrew. We do have these books here in the library, and if you're interested in this subject, please feel free at any time to come by. One other volume that should be mentioned, and that is Flora Palestina, which deals not with the ancient plant life of Palestine, but the modern plant life of Palestine. Again, for a paleoethnobotanist, although you're primarily working with ancient plant remains, this study of modern plant remains is also very important, and especially when it comes to trying to determine whether or not there have been dramatic changes in the climate over the last 5 to 6,000 years. You can check the plant remains that you find from an ancient site against the assemblage or the group of plants that's growing in the area today, and of course if climatic conditions are radically different from today from what they were in ancient times, you'll find quite a difference in those plant assemblages. So the study of modern plants is quite important. A few words about how it is that plant remains are preserved. And perhaps I should say, kind of emphasize the fact that the study of architecture and pottery has more or less detracted from the study of ancient plant remains. That's only partially true. It's not been until very recently that archaeologists came to realize that plant remains are in fact very often, frequently preserved in ancient sites. We all have heard about those cases where in a pyramid we'll find a large bowl of desiccated wheat or barley or something like that. Very seldom do you hear about people finding plant remains on a site. And so if you're in the Friends of Archaeology, I can imagine go out on trips and occasionally look for potsherds or maybe even a hand axe, but very few people go looking for barley grains or wheat or emmer because, again, it just doesn't show up. And certainly one of the reasons that this field of study has been so slow to take off is because archaeologists just didn't realize that plants are preserved as frequently as they are. There are primarily three ways in which plants are preserved from antiquity. One of them is waterlogging. You find this a lot in Europe. A lot of work has been done by Danish scholars taking burials from peat bogs. In some cases, they've gotten beautifully preserved human corpses, not only with the body very well preserved, but the contents of the stomach very well preserved, so that the paleoethnobotanist can dissect this fellow and tell exactly what this Iron Age person had 3,000 years ago as his last meal. Very seldom are plant remains preserved in this manner in the Near East. I don't know if you've noticed, but if you go around Jordan, there really aren't too many swamps or peat bogs where ancient material could be preserved. So although it can be an important means of preservation in this part of the world, it's not important. The second means of preservation is desiccation. That is where a plant is exposed to very hot, dry air and totally loses all of its moisture, becomes desiccated, and therefore preserved. That's the means by which the cereal grains have been preserved in the tombs in Egypt. Although Jordan is a hot, dry place, again, it's a little too moist for much material to survive through desiccation. There are some instances when you get into the Jordan Valley, the Wadi Araba, in the southern part of the country, you will have some plant remains preserved by means of desiccation, but not very frequently. The third means by which plants are often preserved is carbonization, and that's the one which is very helpful here in Jordan. We are finding more and more thousands and thousands of plants at ancient sites. Almost every ancient site has plant remains that have been preserved by means of carbonization. The way in which carbonization takes place is for a plant to be exposed to heat, fairly intensive heat, but not direct flame. Of course, if you take a handful of wheat and throw it into a fire, it'll be reduced to ashes and there won't be anything left to analyze. But we know that one of the common which wheat and barley was processed in ancient times was to put it into a big spoon or some kind of a container like you see these coffee roasters, and to parch the wheat or barley grains in the fire. In this process, very often a few of the grains would drop off near the fire, perhaps go underneath the soil so it would be protected by soil, be exposed to extreme heat but not direct flame, therefore would be transformed into carbon. And in that state, once a seed is transformed into carbon, it's almost indestructible. Have to be careful here. Say it's almost indestructible. That is, it will last for thousands of years, but it's also very fragile. If a goat comes up and steps on it, it can crush it immediately. It's not stable like a rock or a piece of pottery. So carbonized material will last almost indefinitely as long as it's not jostled around, or if the weather changes so that your ancient site is exposed to a lot of water, then of course the seeds can absorb the water and explode or simply be washed away. Certainly, carbonization is the most important means of plant preservation in Jordan and most of the Levant. A couple other things that should be mentioned. Very often you will find in mud bricks that were made in ancient times. So you have both fired mud bricks and sun-dried mud bricks. In both cases, wheat and barley stalks were often used as a temper in the bricks, and so you very often will find in ancient bricks the impressions of different plant remains. That's also a valuable source of information for the paleoethnobotanist, although it's not as valuable as the ancient plant remains itself, because obviously from an impression it's harder to identify exactly what type of plant you have than when you have the actual carbonized plant itself to study and take measurements on and so forth. Okay, the means of recovery for botanical material, the first one is very obvious, that is visual detection during excavation. The problem with simply trying to see the plants as you're excavating is that seeds are generally quite small, especially when you get down. You can see some examples up here too of fig pits, which if you ever bitten into a fig and then look carefully, you'll see hundreds of little tiny seeds inside. Those are frequently preserved at ancient sites, although you hardly ever find them reported in excavation reports. I'm convinced the reason for that is that up until recently, visual detection was the primary means of recovering ancient plant remains. And as you're digging through a 5 meter square, it's very hard to pick out seeds that are a millimeter in diameter. So that's another reason, the means of recovery, why we have so little information on concerning ancient botanical remains. Another method which has been used increasingly is dry sieving, where you simply get a window screen, or very often something a little bit bigger than that, and shake it back and forth, dump the soil in the coffin and shake it back and forth. Some material can be recovered by this means, but there's a basic problem with dry sieving, is in that since most of your botanical material that will have survived from ancient times is carbonized, and as I mentioned, it's very fragile, shoving it back and forth on a sieve is akin to taking the ancient carbonized seed and rubbing it back and forth on a cheese grater. And you'll be lucky, after all the soil was passed through, if any of the plant material that was in the soil to begin with will survive. Another problem is that most screens that are used in dry sieving have a fairly large mesh, so that the only things that you will find are the larger seeded plants, like the topsoil, an almond shell, wheat, barley occasionally, olive mix, and things like that, whereas most of the plant material will pass right through. plant remains, which has been in use for some 20 years now, although amazingly, here in Jordan and elsewhere in the Middle East, it's still very seldomly used. And that is a simple water flotation device. And I'll try to illustrate that. I've got some slides which might give you a better idea, but the equipment can be very, very simple. As you see, just a big pot. On the inside, you've got a screen bottle bucket and two sieves. And all that's necessary is to fill the bucket up about half full of water, put this thing down in it, then dump a soil sample from the excavated area slowly into this device while you move this inner tub back and forth to agitate the water. What happens then is that the soil passes down through the screen and collects in the bottom of this tank. All organic material will float to the top, including all charcoal, snail shells. Very often in Egypt in excavations, you'll find insects, especially if you're putting much brick in a device like this. Insects are often mummified or encased inside mud brick, and they'll come out through the flotation process. And so you simply skim off with a regular kitchen-type strainer the float, as it's called. And then secondly, this isn't often done, but I always like to use a very, very fine strainer to collect anything that's remaining, because although this is a fairly fine mesh, things like big pits and a number of wild types of plant remains can still easily pass through the stream like this. Once you've done that, you've dumped the floats out onto a piece of paper or paper bag, let it dry slowly over 2 or 3 days, then package it up and send it to the laboratory. In the laboratory, that's where the time-consuming process comes in. The float that you get out of a soil sample, 99% of it will be simply chunks of nondescript charcoal, sometimes even light soil, which a lot of organic material in it will float. And so for every sample that takes you maybe 10 to 15 minutes to process in the field, you'll spend anywhere from 10 to 20 hours back in the laboratory just trying to separate out the actual seed remains from charcoal and other debris. I should have mentioned, at the end of each sample, you pull this out, and there are a number of seeds that are large, like olive pits and most nutshells, and occasionally wheat and barley, which will not float. Therefore, they sink to the bottom, and that's the purpose of having a screen here. The screen catches those larger seeds, whereas the soil can actually pass through among them. One thing you will very often find as you're reading reports where devices like this are used is the author will suggest, in the interest of conserving water, that you continue to use the same water until the soil is built up so high that you can't use it anymore. Then you dump it out and start again with the new public water. Although it might seem quite wasteful, the way I've always operated this is after each sample, take the thing and completely clean it out. The problem is if you use the same water over and over again for different samples from different strata of an ancient site, it's very easy to get cross-contamination. And one of the things that we're trying to do with collecting these ancient plant specimens is not simply to say, well, during the early bronze period, they grew barley or they grew wheat. We know that, and that is, in fact, the way most reports are written. During this 1,000 years period, these types of plants were there. But if you're very careful and are digging stratigraphically and in your processing are making sure that each sample is protected from cross-contamination, then you can come up with some more valuable information, such as during the early Bronze One period from 3,200 to 3,000 BC, they were growing roughly the same amount of wheat and barley. Then something seems to change, and they're growing more and more barley and less wheat and so forth. So a carefully done flotation process can yield results so that we can actually see changes that occur in the ancient agricultural system and, again, in the ancient wild flora. This is a very, the simplest flotation device. Since the initial experiments with this type of machine, this type of thing were conducted, they have come out with very sophisticated machines. Now, things known as froth flotation devices, where they'll have a big tank a little higher than these hassocks up to about here, with a bubbler, little motor on the side with a compressor that they shoot compressed air into the bottom of the tank, and then bubbles come up through the tank, which does, of course, mean that you collect more seeds, because as I mentioned, some of the heavier seeds will sink to the bottom of a device like this. So in froth flotation, you can collect a little bit more material, and the claim is made that you can do a lot more soil. In fact, some excavations try to float all of the soil they excavate. After they get the pottery out, they try to take all of the soil and float it. That's not a bad idea. There are several problems with it, though. Usually a froth flotation device is so large that you just can't empty it out every time. Therefore, you always do use the same water until it has to be purged and spilled up with dirt. So, again, I have a problem thinking that a lot of the results are questionable with froth flotation because you never know exactly how much contamination is taking place, how much cross-contamination is taking place. Secondly, although you can recover more material, since the laboratory process for isolating and then identifying the plant remains themselves is so time-consuming, for Baba Draw we've done up till now we've floated about 800 or 900 samples and analyzed about 400 of them. Analyzing those 400 samples took me about 3 years to complete. Some weeks I'd be working 40 to 60 hours doing nothing but separating out the seeds. So it's such a time-consuming process. One thing you very seldom hear of is that the sophisticated machines that collect all of this material, there's no possible way that it could ever be analyzed. Therefore, you end up taking samples of the samples that you floated and still analyzing a very small amount of material in the end. So there are certainly more sophisticated machines, but this is as easy to use, and I think yields probably as good results as any other. I think we'll look at a few pictures now, which will just simply illustrate some of the things we've been talking about. This is a satellite photograph of most of Jordan, or at least the plateau region of Jordan. Everybody will recognize the Dead Sea. This was obviously taken a number of years ago, around 1970. As you can see, at that time there was a southern basin to the Dead Sea. Today there is no southern basin, at least it's dried up completely except for the water that the potash company is pumping into it. You'll hear me talking a little bit in this lecture, and then on Tuesday we'll be concentrating on the sites of Bavidra, right in here, and Numero, which is right down here, which was this area known as the Southern War, was a very important center of civilization from 3000 BC to 2000 BC, during the early Bronze Age. This is the area that my dissertation is based on, and the area that we know most about in terms of the ancient agriculture of Jordan. Just to point out a few other things, here's the Jordan River. This is taken with infrared photography, so all the what would be green normally shows up in red patches. So this red patch here is the green oasis of Jericho. Jerusalem is right over here. Here's the Jabbok River. Jabbok has a biblical name. The Azirka River coming up to Amman right about here. The Wadi Mujib. Azirka Bayin right in here. And this is the Wadi Karak coming up to Karak, which is located right about here. Yeah, I mentioned that one of the ways to recover ancient plant remains is through simple visual detection. And that quite often you can easily overlook the plant remains by this method. At Numera, this site to the south, which is occupied around 23 to 2400 BC, at that particular site we find that there was a destruction which seemed to have come very quickly and rapidly. That's another way in which carbon or plant material is carbonized, accidentally during the destruction of the city. That seems to be the case at Numera because you find, as in this particular instance, several thousand grains of barley scattered over a floor. This white area here is part of a plaster floor with some wood that was also partially charred